Short, 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 long. Not so exciting when I say it out loud, but for composers Ludwig van Beethoven and today's guest, Christopher Rouse, it was fate set to music. I'm Colleen Phelps, and we'll hear more about fifth symphonies, including how they get put together, right now on Keeping Score. I first experienced composer Christopher Rouse as a percussion student in 2002 with his percussion ensemble pieces Bonham and Ogun Badagry. This was the same year that he won a Grammy for his guitar concerto. To know his music from the 1980s as a percussionist is to know energetic, groove-based, rock-infused playing. Just the titles lend an intensity. Gorgon, the Infernal Machine. To know him now as a symphonist is something else altogether. Still rhythmic, but now intentionally lyrical. His orchestral color is often described as lush and almost romantic. Through all this development, though, one thing remains the same. He's not afraid to be loud. That brings us to his symphonies, in particular, his fifth. In October 2017, I got to hear this piece performed by the Nashville Symphony in a concert that included both Rouse's fifth and Beethoven's fifth. Quite the high bar of comparison, but one that Rouse cleared easily. The next morning, Rouse was relaxed, but eventually pretty animated as we sat in his dressing room at the Skirmerhorn Symphony Center. He was talking with his hands quite a bit. In fact, you'll hear his hands hit the microphone as he traces his own influences and even the heritage of the fate motive. Your symphony opens right there with the fate motive.
Right.
Sort of.
As does Beethoven's.
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to begin it with the exact same rhythm and sense of fermata that Beethoven. You know, he goes da-da-da-da. Now, I didn't choose the same notes. I have completely different notes. Fessed up to it. I've known composers who have tried to pass off very derivative music as their own. But beyond that, all composers steal. That rhythm, da-da-da-da, you find it in Haydn all over the place. Well, he was Beethoven's teacher, so maybe Beethoven should give it back to Haydn. But wait, you find that rhythm, I mean, it's a central rhythm to the French Baroque overture. Da-da-da-dum, ba-dum, ba-da-da-dum. So maybe Haydn should give it back to Lully and Rameau. But wait, madrigalists and chanson composers in the Renaissance, you'll find that rhythm many times. So maybe Lully and Rameau should give it back to Jeannequin. And, you know, going the other direction from Beethoven on, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of composers have used da-da-da-da. Maybe some of them intentionally thinking of Beethoven. In other cases, it's just a rhythm. The fifth was the first piece I heard, and because one of the real pleasures in life for me is to thank people who have created things that have made such a difference in my life. And sometimes you're lucky enough, if it's someone who's alive, to be able to thank them personally. And if not, you maybe make a little omaggio to them, a little tip of the cap in what you create. So the Beethoven Fifth having been so important to me, when I was coming to my own Fifth Symphony, I thought, well, I'll give a little shout out to Herr Beethoven, but only use his rhythm, not his notes, not really his form, because I don't want to write a piece that really is more the other person than me.
I loved in the program notes reading you reference hearing Beethoven 5 when you were younger and really into rock music, and that your mother suggested, hey, you might like this too, because I brought my 7-year-old who's super into rock and roll to the performance to hear your piece, but also to really experience Beethoven 5.
Wow. Well, I was 6 at the time, so I don't remember that clearly, except that I just got very wrapped up in it. It was like the sky opening up and revealing, you know, something amazing.
I was thinking, as you quoted Beethoven right in the beginning, of Brahms feeling like he was walking in the footsteps of Beethoven with that sort of same thing hanging over his head, that he was labeled the next great symphonist and he waited so long to write his symphony. Do you identify with that?
To some extent. Yeah. I mean, Brahms was, it's not so much that I feel Beethoven per se hanging over me. I feel Beethoven and Brahms and Tchaikovsky and Haydn and Prokofiev and everybody else who were great symphonists before me. And I do think of the symphony as a serious undertaking. So I didn't really write my official first one until I was in my later 30s. I just didn't feel I'd lived enough of a life yet.
Where do you kind of start in terms of, do you think, I'm writing my 5th symphony, so this is the one where I pay tribute to Beethoven? Or do you sort of work from, this is, you know, modern orchestra, and here's some sounds I've wanted to hear them make all this time?
Mm-hmm. There has to be something that the piece is about. You know, why are you writing it? What are you trying to say?
But where, in terms of the business of it, does some of that get decided? How much of that is negotiated and how much of that is you saying, I want the symphony to be like this? How much did the Dallas and Nashville symphonies have a say in that?
From project to project, it can vary. I don't usually want to take on projects where there's too much of a laundry list of things. Well, we want an overture, and we want it to be a celebratory overture for the opening of our new hall, so we want it to be tonal. Then I'll say, no thanks, that's too much, too many restrictions. But sure, you have to agree on a scoring and a duration and a fee and, you know, various things. But almost always I'm left alone to do stylistically whatever I want.
In a piece that you, if I read it correctly in the program notes, you say it's not programmatic, the symphony, not programmatic.
Well, I believe all music is programmatic except for Hannon exercises or something like that, you know, piano exercises, in the sense that it's meant to evoke emotional states and elicit emotional responses. To me, when we use the word programmatic, we really mean storytelling music, or music that is very specific in what it is meant to convey, like Strauss' Don Quixote or something like that. But if we include the idea that there is expressivity, the composer is trying to communicate a state of an emotional state or states, then to me all music is programmatic, and this piece would be programmatic in that sense. It's not a narrative. It's not a, you know, the kind of, tribulation to triumph image that the Beethoven Fifth gives you. But it is meant to convey a series of emotional states that you hope the audience will pick up on. I do a lot of mental sketching. I won't actually start writing a piece until I've made a lot of decisions in my head about how the piece is going to proceed. And when I feel I've got enough of that, then I can start writing. But the only actual writing I do is just the final score.
Do you, you know, like a playwright, have, you know, a chart with the form, or is it all up in your head.
No, it's in my head. And, you know, sometimes with this symphony, I was well into it when I came to an uh-oh moment. I had decided that it would be a four-movement symphony because I hadn't written one. All my symphonies heretofore have been something other than a standard four-movement. So I thought, okay, Beethoven is four movements, I'll be four movements. And like Beethoven, I'll be fast, slow, scherzo, fast finale. And I thought, and you know what I'm going to do? Because it was really quite radical when Beethoven did it, is I'm going to connect the scherzo to the finale. You know, there's no break. There's that long timpani part. And we just gradually move from the scherzo, and then finally it resolves into the finale. So I thought, I'm going to do that. And I'm going to use the timpani part just as Beethoven wrote it. It'll be at a much faster speed, but that's what I'm going to do. So that was a given. But then I reached a point in the slow movement where I thought, you know, the voice perching, you know, on your shoulder saying, this has gone on long enough. But on my other shoulder, but there's more I want to do with this. It's gone on long enough. There's more I want to do. So I thought, well, now what am I going to do about this? And then this has been one of the good things about having a lot of music in my ears. I thought of Franz Berwald, Swedish composer of the early 19th century, who in one of his quartets and also in one of his symphonies, midway through the slow movement, just introduces his entire scherzo and then goes back and completes the rest of the slow movement. So it's kind of like an arch form. I thought, I can do that. I can just go into my scherzo from here and then come back and finish the slow movement. But how am I going to get from the scherzo to, from the scherzo to the finale if I'm going to be ending my slow movement after the scherzo? So then I thought, well, then I'm going to have to divide the scherzo as well. So I'll get 80% of the way through the slow movement, then the scherzo, 80% of the way through the scherzo, go back to the slow movement and complete the other 20%, then back to the scherzo for the last 20%, and then on to the finale. But that wasn't something that I had planned.
Since the piece is new without the chance to study the score, I kind of got one pass. But I was sort of looking, after that moment, I was looking for other great symphonists to be found somewhere in the piece. And I don't know if any of this was deliberate, but there was a moment in the Wind Color where I thought of the Persichetti Wind Symphonies.
That's interesting. No, I wasn't thinking of the Persichetti Wind Symphony per se, but I do think of this as a very American piece. Without the example of people like Walter Piston and William Schumann, I don't think it would be what it is or sound the way it sounds. I love that generation of American symphonists. There were so many great ones. There were, you know, Harris and Menon and a whole slew of them, Roger Sessions. There are certain kinds of articulation, certain kinds of rhythms, certain kinds of orchestration that I associate particularly with American composers of that generation.
We'll link to some examples of the music of William Schumann and Vincent Persichetti on our website at 91classical.org. Rouse didn't quote these composers directly, but he did tell a story about accidentally quoting composer John Adams, who was luckily a good sport about it.
There was one, I must say, right towards the end, in my piece is a B-flat major triad, kind of a little sort of a fanfare. I thought that was just something that I had come up with. And then a couple months after the premiere, I was playing Short Ride in a Fast Machine at Juilliard for whatever reason. And all of a sudden, I hear the brass go, bop, 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 ba, bop, 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 bop. And I thought, oh my God, I stole it from John. So I wrote an email to him. I said, John, if you ever hear this piece, I explained to him the story that I've just told to you. And he said, listen, we all do it. It's perfectly all right. Because I stole your title from the Infernal Machine. So, you know, I stole your title, you stole a major triad in the brass. It's all good.
It's time for a short break. While you wait, enjoy this clip of Rouse's orchestral piece, The Infernal Machine, performed by the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra under the direction of David Zimmerman.
When you want to listen to classical music but aren't near a radio, 91 Classical is still your source for great performances from Middle Tennessee and around the world. Stream music on our website while you work. Tune in via the Nashville Public Radio app on your smartphone, or tell your smart speaker you'd like to hear 91 Classical.
I'm Colleen Phelps. Welcome back to Keeping Score. That was a clip from The Infernal Machine by Christopher Rouse, apparently the namesake for John Adams' piece, Short Ride on a Fast Machine. And now, here's Christopher Rouse. You've been called the leading symphonist of our time. What's it like to have that kind of label over your head?
I don't really think about it too much. People say things. Sometimes they're nice, sometimes they're not nice, but you really can't take any of it seriously. It's like reviews. You know, you ignore the bad reviews, but you also have to ignore the good reviews. So you have to know yourself. And maybe with the input of some very close friends or colleagues whose opinions you respect, as to whether you're doing what you want to do as well as you can do it. And everything else is window dressing. I had decided to become a composer when I was 6 and then proceeded not to write any music. I just listened to music voraciously. That was my preparation. I never learned to play an instrument. I didn't study music theory. I mean, I did it all wrong. But eventually, it was my senior year, and I had to make plans to go off to a conservatory, and they required 2 completed pieces, so I wrote my first 2 pieces, one of which was a little choral thing, and the other was a symphony, which I numbered 2, because I thought it was more impressive to imply that I'd already written one before that.
Like the Traveling Wilburys, their 3rd album was actually their 2nd album.
There you go.
Who are your go-to rock groups for influence?
Oh, Lordy. There's so many. I suppose, if I had to name a triumvirate, of people, Roger McGuinn and the Byrds, Paul Kantner of Jefferson Airplane and Starship, but specifically his material, his songs, and Paul Simon, who continues to completely amaze me with his imagination and his musicianship. He's what an extraordinary, extraordinary songwriter he is. But, geez, I mean, there's so many bands and other people that I just love. It would take all day to enumerate them all. I do not play the piano at all, and I'm not being modest, so I can't use it as a tool. And so I've been forced to hear things in my head, which really is something most composers should learn to do anyway. Not have to rely on an instrument to give them their ideas. You can check things, I would say, on an instrument, but it's best to hear things in your head first. And so in my case, I have no choice. And And in that sense, I'm kind of glad that I have never learned to play an instrument, because many of the best orchestrators were non-pianists or non-instrumentalists. Berlioz couldn't play an instrument. Rimsky-Korsakov was not a pianist at all. Even right up to what I mentioned, William Schumann, he couldn't play any instrument with any facility. But they were all great orchestrators because, as Berlioz said, ideas occurred to him already orchestrated. There was not a separate act of composing the piece in, let's say, a piano format or a short score, and then orchestrating it. It was all one integrated process. The music was already orchestrated when it first occurred to them, to those composers, which is true for me too. I don't hear an idea. I hear a string idea, or I hear a brass idea, or I hear an oboe line. Instead of just a line, it's an oboe line right from the start. And I think a lot of that comes from not being able to work with an instrument when I'm composing.
That makes me think of Alice Parker talking about how she deliberately turned down opportunities to study with prominent voice teachers because she wanted to make sure everything she wrote was singable in a choral setting, that, you know, an untrained voice could still make these lines make sense. Any advice for, you know, students who think, like you said, I decided I wanted to be a composer, but then I didn't write a note of music?
Oh. Well, don't do that. Well, you know, I do always say, you know, composing is not something you go into to make a lot of money or become a star or, you know, famous, and you know, forget that. You do it because you have to. And I always tell students, look, if there's something else you can imagine doing and, you know, feeling happy and fulfilled doing besides composing, go do that. Because composing is incredibly challenging, sometimes agonizing, very, very difficult, usually not very remunerative. And it's something, you know, I say sometimes, because I do, I hate composing. I despise it. I'm absolutely miserable when I'm composing, and I will come up with any rationale that I can to avoid it. Oh, that movie opens today. I've got to go see it. Ball game on, you know, whatever. Anything to not compose. But if somebody says, well, why do you do it then? My answer is because the only thing worse than composing is not composing. We are impelled. We realize that that is why we are here on this planet, is to create music.
Keeping Score is a production of Nashville Public Radio and 91 Classical. The show is edited by Nina Cardona and Anita Bug. In this episode, we heard a performance by the Nashville Symphony, engineered by Gary Call, that included Beethoven and Rouse's Fifth Symphonies. We also heard Christopher Rouse's The Infernal Machine, performed by the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Next time, we'll talk to pianist Yefim Bronfman about a concerto he's played over 100 times. I'm Colleen Phelps. Thanks for listening to Keeping Score.